We'll hear first from Mr. Mignola, and then from David Hopkins. Yes, do you wish to give sworn testimony?
I guess so.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Okay. My name is Don Mignola. Don, that's easy. D-O-N. Mignola, M-I-G, as in George. N-O-L-A. I live in West Valley. I obviously pay money to the power company, but I don't have net metering. Okay. Now, I had planned on speaking entirely about the cost of this extra fee and some related costs, but in the last couple of days, I've heard some discussion about electric cars and a few other things, some of which from the utility company. So I feel compelled to just to take a few statements ahead of time just to clarify a few issues. You won't see any of that in my documentation. It's true that most of the energy and the pollution that is generated for our electrical use here is generated some other place. It's also true that the vehicles, their tailpipes, are what's producing most of the pollution, okay? Now, that happens to be my first effort to clean up the environment. That goes back about 25 years. I will make the following statement, which will alarm some of you. People have been predicting what's going to happen with electric cars, and it's always fallen short. I'm going to make a statement that between 2015 and 2020, you're going to see an escalation of electric vehicles, and you're going to see it because of two technologies. I won't go into those today, but you will find that that's going to make a major difference. We're going to see a huge change, and that is going to require electrical power at the home primarily, because that's where most of the usage is going to be. If we want electric vehicles, we have to have enough electrical power at the home in order to accommodate this. There's a couple of other requirements on the road that's going to be necessary, but I just want to put that into perspective for everybody, okay? Now, one of the big questions has been, will this increase that we're talking about discourage homeowners from going for this program? I have some of the answers that I think might feel helpful. But first, what I'd like to say is that there's some other things that we should look at before jumping ahead. Now, I've sent you gentlemen a document, and you got some of it with you. So some of the rest of you have seen what I've already sent to them. The one thing you don't see is the 44 pages that I sent to these gentlemen that pertain to what EPRI has prepared in February. Now, in next month, they are scheduled to produce another phase two of this study that they're doing. Now, what they're calling it is the Integrated Grid Realizing the Full Value of Central and Distributed Energy Sources. That is really what we're talking about, but they're looking at a global way of doing this. Phase two will go into more details and more stuff that we can get our teeth into, and so I would strongly urge that be the basis of study to find out really if we can make some differences as to how we look at those costs. Because I think that most of you know who an EPRI is. Is that right? Do I have to explain that? Okay. So that's what I've had to say. Now, if a client came to me and said, "What can we do to be more efficient? Where do we start?" I would probably say, "Let's go after the low-hanging fruit." There's a lot of reasons for that, but that's what I would do. Now, if I were asking that same question of our utility companies, I would say that $25 that they say costs them every month for every customer is a low-hanging fruit. I've also heard the number of $70, and I'm not sure what the differences are there, but that is where we need to go. Regardless of whether it makes sense or not, if you're going to lower, that's something that should be looked at for lowering the cost. There's no excuse for that being that high, okay? And I've spent most of my adult life consulting for major corporations and making them more efficient and giving them tools. And that's where I would go if that question was to me. So I think that that's what we should look at. And Phase 2 report is a good place to start. Okay, now this business of what the homeowner is going to do. Well, in 2012, Sarah Wright's group made a major push to put solar cells on the rooftops in Salt Lake City. They had an outreach program that was very effective. We had to select an installer, and so we put out bids. Three of us reviewed those bids and made the selection. But what I did was I went back afterwards talking to them and did some other things to analyze what worked and what didn't work. And I'm not going to go into all the things that I found out, but I'm going to tell you what I think is the most crucial thing of all. Now, the equipment and installation is guaranteed for 25 years. The payback is about half that time. Okay? So on the surface, it looks like a very good investment, you know, in that period of time. One of the problems is that the longest loan you can get is short of what the payback period is. As a consequence, the homeowner who takes out the loan is going to be paying more per month than they did before until the loan is paid off. That's bad. That's a disincentive. So what needs to be done is we need to find ways of turning that around. Now, the experience was that the tree huggers that were presented with this signed up and made the installation. The penny pitchers didn't. The unfortunate part is for every tree hugger, there were three penny pushers. That's an untapped source that we missed. If we can get the cost down per month, that will make a big difference. So I've given that a lot of thought, and I have a plan. It has three phases to it, but I believe within 5 years we could have 50% of the houses in Utah with solar panels on their roof. I'm not planning on going to all those details today. If the commissioners would be interested at some time in the future, I'd be more than happy to go over that with you, because together we might be able to accomplish something in that area. And I'm talking about something that does not require any more subsidies or anything like that. It's putting the incentives where they belong. Okay? Now, what about an incentive or a disincentive with this particular surcharge? If we can lower the price so that the homeowner is now paying less than what they did before, you're going to find people signing up. But if they're on the border and this charge puts them in the other direction, they're not going to sign up. That's simple. And it's and just look at the experience we've had in Salt Lake City. There's no question about that. If they're on the margin, they're going to think twice. But the biggest deterrent with this, I believe, is that the people that might be prone to sign up and they see this extra charge, they're going to ask the question, what's going to happen next year and the year after that? Is this just the getting our foot in the door and these charges are going to go up and up and up? That is going to be the deterrent. So there's a psychological factor here that I believe is extremely strong, and we should do everything we can to avoid it. Okay? Now, I'd like to make some comments about the study that the utility company made near the university. Now, the way I understand the purpose of this study was to take one group, one area, and then project to the rest of the state of what might be practical. I'm all in favor of that. That makes a lot of sense. And I was all excited about that until I read the report. Mm-hmm. To say I was disappointed is an understatement. Now, here's my problems with that. First of all the stuff that they went through to make their calculations is ridiculous. They're talking about what NASA does to the environment and the atmosphere and measuring that. That can be entirely avoided. It's not necessary to do that in order to come up with a reasonable conclusion. The next thing is they missed probably the most important thing to use as a guide, and that's the temperature. Now, they should also have had cameras up there to see how much cloud is covered and that sort of stuff for this type of study. But the key thing is the temperature. And if they can make a correlation between the production of those cells at various angles and temperature, that can be projected to the rest of the state, because we already know what the temperatures are at various parts of the state. You don't know it on a day-to-day basis, but we know it year by year. So that was one of my problems. My other problem was the area they picked around the university. Why in the world did they do that? Now, some of you have got this other handout. You can see the top one is a photo that was in their report, and it shows the structures and the trees. There are more trees than structures covering everything. Now, why in the world would you pick some place that is covered with trees? This is an old neighborhood. Old neighborhoods tend to have tall trees. The tall trees cover the roofs. So this is no place to, that's not your first choice. You should be going after areas where there are already not a lot of trees, which is most of Utah. So this is not indicative. The second thing, and those of you who have the handout there, this was also in their plan. It shows one of the houses. And what can you expect from these old houses? Peak roofs. Real sharp peak roofs. And also a lot of twists and turns on the thing. Now, that's no place to put. Those aren't prime suspects for photovoltaic cells. You can't do anything with them, and there's not enough space. So this was a bad choice of places to look for. I don't know if they did this or not, but it would have made a lot more sense to get a hold of EPRI and or the National Lab in Golden, Colorado, and see if they have something that could have been used, which would have been more universal. So, okay, that's the point there. Now, the next thing I would like to deal with is this summer hot spikes that are due to heavy use of air conditioners. Now, our solar cells are at a particular angle, and that causes less sun to hit them and produce electricity than other times. Okay? If the cells move so that they're always perpendicular to the sun's rays, you would pick up 30% more energy. That's a pretty universal figure that it's accepted pretty much in the industry. The problem is that it's expensive to do that. Every one of these cells needs a unit there to twist it with the sun. Well, there's a new device out, brand new. And what it does is it travels around and tweaks all of the things every few minutes. And it goes around a few months later and does it again. Now, I don't know where the break is and how many cells you need in order to do this, but there's that is going to make it cost effective. And what does that do, that 30%? That 30% is not going to necessarily raise the peak. It's going to spread out the peak. And when you do that, you're going to have higher energy production at the beginning of the day and higher energy at the end of the day. And this business of a 7%, whether that number means anything or not, goes out the window, because with this, you're going to get something like 30% efficiency. So that's going to change all of this is a game changer, and it is good for the utility company because it's going to even out their flow. The peak is not going to be as drastic. Okay, so that's something that I think we should support. Now, there's another thing that goes on. When the temperature goes up, efficiency goes down of the photovoltaic cells. We've known this for years. Okay, it also shortens the life of the cell when it really gets hot. Now, they've tried various ways of cooling them down. Unfortunately, these ways are too expensive to make them cost effective. However, there's good news. Stanford professor has come up with a passive way of doing this, so there's no ongoing cost. They intend to commercialize this as soon as they can, and I wouldn't be surprised if they commercialize it sometime next year, if not the year after. That's going to increase the efficiency of these cells. It's going to make them last longer, but it's going to extend the energy produced at the end of the day disproportionately, because as these cells heat up, they lose their efficiency, and their efficiency goes down. Now, if all of a sudden the clouds come over and stop everything, the cells aren't just going to whoop up and cool down. They're going to gradually cool down. But if we can keep them cool all the time, they're going to produce higher electrical energy at the end of the day than they do now. That's also going to affect that 7% figure. So that's something we should look forward to and move to these things. What we should be doing is looking through these technologies. The rate thing you're talking about is not for today and tomorrow. It's for next year and the next year. And the technology is going to be different next year. So this is what we should be looking for, is the technology that comes tomorrow and the year after it when you're setting the rate. Okay? So much for that lecture. All right. Now we're going to really... I hope you're all sitting down. There are ways of limiting almost all the electrical energy used by air conditioners. Now think about that. If we could eliminate most of the air conditioning expense, all of this problem of this peak load will be essentially eliminated. To the utility company, that means that they don't have to provide for this excess capacity. That means that it's far more profitable to do it that way. Now, how do you go about that? How is that done? And is this some high-tech stuff? No, it's not. It's low-tech. It's already being done in Utah. And there's some pictures that will show this. The air a few feet down in Utah is 55 degrees. If we pick up that temperature, we don't need air conditioning. You pick up the energy with tubes down several feet down. It cools down the air or liquid in those tubes. You pipe that up to either if it's liquid, you're pumping that into a solar heating system, in the floor, okay? Now, instead of being just solar heating in the floor, you got solar cooling in the floor. And you don't need a compressor. You don't need all the other stuff. Now, what does this cost? Well, it costs very all over the ballpark. In general, it's the cost of installation is somewhere between that of a swamp cooler and an air conditioner. The maintenance of both of these present systems is high. The maintenance of this system is almost nil. The cost for moving either this liquid or air through the system is less than moving the air with a swamp cooler, and there's no water involved in the process. And the comfort level is terrific. There's nothing better than that. Now, I ask you, this system is a game changer. It can eliminate all the summer electrical spikes. It can eliminate the need for additional electrical capacity for years to come. It can eliminate far more than the proposed month's charge. It makes that thing look like chump change as far as effect on the utility company, and it makes it more sense. Is there any reason why we shouldn't pursue this alternative vigorously? I mean, if we said let's try and talk 20% of our homes every year, we can make a huge difference in a very short period of time. And I believe that's one of the things we want to do. Now, I got one other. Oh, my goodness, I screwed up. I turned the page. Okay. There's another technology, and it's not new technology. It's called thermal mass. A house using the principles of thermal mass stays about the same temperature 24 hours a day and 365 days a year. You only need a small amount of energy to tweak it once in a while. That's the way this works. Now, the physics of this is a little hard to explain, so I'm not going to go on in all those details. I'll tell you more about what works and give you some authenticity resolutions. First of all, the temperature in a thermal mass not only remains constant, but people are more comfortable in one of these homes when the temperature is actually lower. This is radiation, and it works very much like the sun. Now, you know that if you're in the shade and then you walk out in the sun, it gets a lot hotter. This works the same way. The big difference is you don't get sunburned. That's the good news. But it works the same way. So people are comfortable, and people that normally, I'm too cold or the other person is too hot, those problems tend to go away with this type of system. So you're actually more comfortable. And if we can do the heating and cooling, it makes sense. Now, the man that wrote the book on this has actually built some homes this way. And Utah Power gave them a special accommodation. So I think there's a lot of credibility to it that the utility company can verify, because they wouldn't be passing out these types of credentials if it wasn't I'm sure they validated this before. So this system was also a game changer. And now, is there any reason why we shouldn't also pursue this? Now, this is only practical primarily for a new home, okay? But we can encourage these things to happen. So what I'm saying that this $4 or $5 or whatever it's going to be is going to discourage some people, not everybody. It's going to discourage some people. It ticks off a lot of people. I can tell you that. If you talk to people, they get mad about it. And that is not good for the utility company, and it is not good for any regulatory agency. Discourages that sort of thing. There are alternatives. There's technology is going to make a huge difference this year and next year that we need to take advantage of. And let's not be short-sighted. Let's move to these things, and then let's do these things that will make a real change, a major change, so that the load that the utility has to plan for is not have these huge ups and downs. It's going to be steadier. It's a better investment in capital. Okay? Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Mignola. Any questions?
I thought the utility company would be asking me some questions.
You're excused. David Hopkins, followed by Ray Wheeler. Thank you. Do you intend to offer sworn testimony?
Yes.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yep. Yes.
Thank you. Please be seated.
My name's David Hopkins, H-O-P-K-I-N-S. I live in Salt Lake County in the Mill Creek area. And I am a customer of Rocky Mount Power and also a net metering customer. In 2010 and 11, two different times I installed solar on my home with the assistance of Rocky Mount Power. Part of the rebate program, I received rebates from them and signed a contract and turned over part of the renewable energy credits to them. From my point of view, it was a positive relationship or partnership to help add power and stability to Utah's grid, if you will. Okay. I also purchased the next year a Chevy Volt, which I operate there, and my wife mostly drives it, and she plugs it in at work as well. So save quite a bit of money. Now, the sizing of the grid that I have, the array I have on my home, is really set up to take advantage of the tiered rates that we have. You guys have created a really kind of interesting system, in that what it advantage it gives to a homeowner if he sets an array up properly is that I pay, you know, the maximum rate is around 14 cents kilowatt hour in the summer. So my panels are set fairly shallowly to take advantage of that. I don't net zero. I don't really have an intent to do that, because I don't really see an advantage to that because of the sliding scale. From the point of the way I view the way Rocky Mount Power, at least what I thought, the way they were looking at that was their demands in the summertime on their infrastructure are high because of ambient temperatures and solar absorption in transformers and high loads, which causes transformers to age prematurely and in some cases die because of the increased load. And and just the temperature during the year. So One of the things that concerns me is that as PV prices drop, which they have for the last 40 years, basically they started out at $1,000 a watt, and now they're down to maybe on the PV, on the cell themselves, down in the range of a dollar to maybe 50 cents. And it's going to continue. This is a disruptive technology that's going to change how power is produced and distributed. And what I don't get is that Rocky Mountain Power isn't taking advantage of that. Utah's a kind of an odd place. We've got all of us Westerners living on top of each other in this valley, producing pollution and all these other things. And then we have this huge grid that kind of runs all these wires running around Utah. And especially in southern Utah, where it gets fairly warm. And I think in a lot of cases, it's overloaded and it's expensive to operate. Using distributed power in that sort of situation seems like an obvious solution to generating power and reducing maintenance on a grid, because some of the most expensive components are thermally and load sensitive. Why don't they take advantage of it? And really what I'm here to do is to try to push you three to consider that in the future, what we should be looking at is trying to strategically take advantage of those situations to reduce, not increase, the rate structure in this state. And I think with falling prices of PV, attaching PV to homes, like in my case, I'm at the end of a line. I've got a big transformer hanging on a pole behind my house. You know, it's a 50 kV. It serves 16 customers. And I put out power to all those people. Okay, all it really does to Rocky Mountain Power is make that transformer last longer. And the substation reduces their load. And the other dozen people like me in my neighborhood reduces the load in that neighborhood. And on a hot day, Rocky Mountain Power gets to sell it to the Smiths down the road at a high demand charge. And that sort of opportunity in, you know, places like Moab, where I'm from, gets pretty warm down there. Things blow up. So it creating these blanket categories and not being smart will make it so we pay a lot more money in the future. And I really would like to see a sort of leadership from the Public Service Commission to try to push Rocky Mountain Power, as you've, I think, done with the subsidy I received from them, okay, on the rebate, to look at commercial and domestic agriculture. I'm a skier, and every time I get on a ski lift, I think the substations and the power grid that supports this place gets used 5% of the time, you know? There's mining operations. People are pumping water in Delta in the summer. But the rest of the time, what's it doing? That grid's kind of sitting there. So if I put up solar panels next to a pump, and this is something they do in Texas, okay? And I pump water out of the ground, or I pump it into my sprinklers. In the summer, there's a pretty high load. And I would imagine when Rocky Mountain Power laid out their grid, they minimized their investment. Okay, so those transformers and that grid are probably undersized because it only really gets tested part of the year. So my suggestion is that instead of doing these blanket increases in rates for people, that they invest and that the Public Service Commission pushes Rocky Mountain Power to look at strategies where they can support failing infrastructure or infrastructures that might be at load, or that are just underutilized. And the nice thing about solar, it's a very entrepreneurial thing. It doesn't take huge investments. It doesn't take going to Wall Street and getting $1 billion, okay? You just go incrementally look for these opportunities. And there's you know, low-hanging fruit. There's got to be a lot of it out there. So that's why I'm concerned, and I oppose this kind of blanket increase on solar, because what it's going to do is it's going to hold Utah back. And it's going to, you know, somebody said it's going to make us look schizophrenic, and it does. We need to invest smartly. I mean, that's what I thought I was doing with Rocky Mountain Power. But right now, they're going to come back and start charging me. And I'm like, you know, I signed a contract, and there's renewable energy credits that they're going to sell someday. It's just a strange relationship. So thank you for your time, especially staying here so late in a hot room with suits on and ties. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hopkins, questions for Mr. Hopkins? Thank you. Ray Wheeler, followed by Josh, and I forgot, is it Sherman?
I saw Mr. Sherman on the elevator, and he apologized to me. He said he'd had to leave.
Okay. Thank you. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. My name is Ray Wheeler. I'm a resident of Salt Lake City and a net metered customer of Rocky Mountain Power. I'm also a board member of the Association for the Tree of Life, which is deeply involved in trying to facilitate a power transformation to renewable energy nationwide. The Earth Restoration Network, which has published a 500-page master plan for converting our country to full sustainability for food, water, and carbon-free, nuclear-free energy within one lifetime. And of the Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance, on whose board I sit as an advisor. Thank you for all your time tonight. It was quite heroic of you to sit for so many hours and listen to this testimony. And also thank you to all those people who have preceded me. I'm just fascinated by all the information that's come out of this. It's been a very rich hearing process. I am here to encourage the commission, like so many others have tonight, not to apply the proposed new fee for net metering services for solar power providers. No such fee should be applied until an independent audit is done to determine the true costs and benefits of solar power shows that costs to Rocky Mountain Power ratepayers exceed the benefits. In our country, public utilities, public entities frequently and massively subsidize private for-profit entities on the grounds that such subsidies are justified because the subsidized entities are providing an important public service such as energy, food, national defense, or jobs, and should therefore be given an incentive for providing the needed service in the form of subsidies, which sometimes range into the billions of dollars. I would like to step back and give you a big picture overview of the primary reasons, or one cluster of primary reasons, to incentivize the growth of solar power production capacity throughout Utah, and especially here on the Wasatch Front. When we think about the big picture, we are not talking only about the immediate effects of slapping a fee onto the cost of providing net metered service for solar providers. Those effects are actually quite large, up to 70% reduction in applications for new solar projects in the case of Arizona. But what is far more important to consider is the consequences of adopting a posture of discouraging rather than encouraging the fastest possible build-out of alternative clean energy production capacity here in Utah and elsewhere throughout the world. Last year, my wife and I invested about $17,000 to put a 5-kilowatt solar system on our roof. This was our net cost after a 30% tax write-off on our federal income taxes. $17,000 was a large piece of our personal savings and a lot of money to invest all at once. We did it. So why did we choose to help finance and build the long-term alternative energy production capacity of Rocky Mountain Power? We did it because we knew enough about the consequences of addiction to fossil fuel energy to believe that we had a moral obligation to assist in the transformation of our country to clean and renewable energy. I want to give you a summary now of what I consider to be the most important logistical and moral problem that we as a species face, and that is global warming, something which seems abstract, off in the future, not our problem today, here and now. I want to bring it into your consciousness and try to raise your consciousness as to its immediacy. According to the overwhelming 97% consensus of 2,500 of the most distinguished climate scientists in the world, human-caused carbon dioxide pollution has already caused, with the certainty of 90%, a 1 degree Fahrenheit average Earth temperature increase since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That increase has brought us to a level not seen for the past 400 years and the fastest, and has been the fastest rise in average temperature in the past 1,000 years. If human activity continues to release greenhouse gases, mainly carbon dioxide and methane, into the Earth's atmosphere as extrapolated for ongoing population growth and industrialization, that will cause a 4 degree to 11 degree Fahrenheit increase in the average global temperature. Now, a few degrees one way or the other, what difference does it make? It makes a huge difference. An increase of just a few degrees has immense impacts on weather, water supply, agriculture, wildfires, biodiversity, fisheries, and every other aspect of life on Earth. For example, during the last ice age, average global temperature was just 5 to 9 degrees cooler than it is now. And that resulted in the accumulation of up to 3,000 feet of glacial ice on much of North America, where there is no ice today. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in 1750, average global temperatures have been increasing in precise lockstep with atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide gas, which traps heat radiating from the Earth's surface. CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere has increased 34% since 1750, and 62% of the increase occurred since 1959. But the immediate evidence of global warming is obvious and dramatic. Glaciers have been retreating worldwide since 1850, and the rate of recession has dramatically increased since 1980. Glaciers on the Tibet-Qinghai Plateau at the head of China's Yellow and Yangtze rivers are melting at 7% a year. At this rate, 2/3 of that glacial ice will disappear within 50 years. These disappearing glaciers feed all of the major rivers of Asia, including the Indus, Ganges, Mekong, Yangtze, and Yellow Rivers. Over the past three decades, more than 1 million square miles of perennial sea ice, an area the size of Norway, Denmark, and Sweden combined, has melted away. In the past decade, we have seen a 40% reduction in polar sea ice, a loss of ice area 5 times the size of Great Britain. Sea ice is shrinking by 6% per year and at increasing rates. Scientists at the U.S. Center for Atmospheric Research predict that if current global warming rate continues, the Arctic will be ice-free in the summer by 2040. Meanwhile, gigantic... Whoa, I lost my place, sorry. Gigantic blocks of shelf ice are breaking away in polar regions. In 2000 and 2002, ice shelves nearly the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island broke off the Ross Ice Shelf and the Thwaites Glacier. The melting of sea ice and continental shelf ice, together with glacial melt-off, will inexorably drive a rise in sea level. As the planet warms, various food feedback loops kick in to cause accelerating release of greenhouse gases and a greater absorption of heat into our oceans. Melting of sea ice reduces reflectivity, and increases heat absorption in polar regions. Melting of permafrost and warming of oceans could release huge amounts of methane, a greenhouse gas 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide in its capacity to trap heat. Top U.S. climatologist James Hansen of NASA suggests that our climate is just 2 degrees centigrade short of tipping point beyond which we can expect irreversible runaway global warming. Hansen suggests that we have just 8 years now to reverse the flow of carbon into the atmosphere before we cross a tipping point threshold and create what he calls a different planet. No one knows for sure exactly how close the irreversible climate change feedback loop tipping points may be. The processes are complex and their interactions are not fully understood. However, the most recent estimates that I've seen by the world's top climate experts suggest that we are no more than 20 years from the point of no return. They suggest that we must see something like an 85% reduction in fossil fuel use by mid-century. And we all know that wholesale conversion from a fossil fuel distribution and production system to a renewable energy system will take decades to fully accomplish. To get ahead of this problem, we need to start immediately. Consider the consequences of a hot planet for ecosystems and nations that are already strained to the breaking point. Total loss of the world's greatest rainforest due to drought and wildflower on top of massive accelerating commercial logging worldwide. Elimination of all polar sea ice within 1 to 2 lifetimes and melting of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice shields, driving up ocean levels by an estimated 39 to 56 feet in elevation. Flooding of major coastal cities and farmland worldwide, displacing anywhere from 100 to 600 million people and destroying millions of acres of the world's most fertile cropland. Complete melt-off within 20 years of the mountain glaciers that feed most of the world's major rivers, including those of the Himalayan highlands that provide irrigation water to 1/6 of the world's population. Increase in drought and desertification and crop failures due to rising temperatures. Accelerating crashing of ocean fisheries due to acidification of ocean water and, incidentally, the loss of the coral reefs of the world within a remarkably short period of time. Radical transformation of ecosystems worldwide as climate zones literally move northward and upward in elevation. A major surge in already alarming rates of plant and animal species extinction, now approaching 1,000 times the background rate, normal background rate of species extinction. A recent book by eminent military correspondent Gwen Dyer concludes, based on interviews with leading military intelligence analysts in most of the major countries of the world, that the consensus of the military intelligence community worldwide is that global warming is not merely a reality and huge threat to humanity as well as to plant and animal life, but furthermore, it will be a primary threat to national security worldwide. That's because climate-driven drought and famine, destabilization of governments through civil unrest by hundreds of thousands of starving, desperate people, displacement of hundreds of millions of climate refugees, wars over scarce resources of food and water, such as rivers that are shared by multiple countries, all constitute major threats to national security throughout the world. Already as a result of depletion of natural resources, in relation to exploding world population, we see about 60 countries identified in the category of failed or failing states. If these scenarios seem hypothetical or abstract, consider the case of Darfur in the country of Sudan. Between 1950 and 2007, Sudan's population quadrupled. The stress of extreme population growth has been intensified by two decades of drought. According to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, the prolonged drought coincided with the rise in the temperature of the Indian Ocean that disrupted seasonal monsoons, a direct result of global warming. The consequences of climate change for Sudan were 20 years of warfare during which 4 million people died.
Mr. Commissioner, I apologize. I appreciate the educational opportunity with respect to global warming and as well as the parade of horribles repeated, but I have to express concern of the how far afield we have now come from the subject matter that is at issue, both in today's hearing as well as the general rate case in as a whole.
Who is this gentleman?
He's counsel for the Office of Consumer Services.
So. Really?
Yes, sir, I am.
You fail to see any relevance between the warming of the climate.
If you'd allow me, please.
And incentivization of a rapid conversion to renewable, clean, carbon-free energy. Is that true? Is that the case?
Mr. Wheeler, just allow me to address his objection, if you wouldn't mind. Would you give us a sense of how much more you have for us this evening for our planning purposes?
Not too much more. How much is too much? I mean, this is huge. These are huge issues. You're a consumer advocate, sir?
Mr. Wheeler, if you're going to be done soon, why don't you just continue with...
Thank you.
But let me ask you to read just a little slower for the benefit of the reporter. I'm sure she's...
I can send you a transcript. I don't have one printed out.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
How many failed states does it take to make a failed civilization? How many Syrias, how many Iraqs, Libyas, and Pakistans can the U.S. afford to invade and govern at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer? Why would we subsidize the extremely profitable oil industry with millions in oil depletion allowance subsidies when we have the alternative of incentivizing clean energy solutions such as solar power? Why would we pour trillions of dollars of taxpayer subsidy into the U.S. military establishment when we're already spending more than all other countries of the world combined on our spending on their national defense systems in a desperate and impossible attempt to stabilize and control the highly volatile oil-producing countries of the Middle East? The consequences of fossil fuel addiction are not simply distant in time and space. They're immediate and close at hand. They're highly visible in our air here on the Wasatch Front. At least we can see what we're breathing. But this is bad. The consequences of fossil fuel dependency will soon be visible in our local economy as ski resorts fail to lack of snow, and the proposed doubling of the population of the Wasatch Front becomes impossible due to the lack of water. With global demand for oil and gas increasing with population and supply of cheap oil now failing, energy price inflation will ripple across the global economy, inexorably driving prices up, forcing interest rates to increases to control inflation and tanking global markets and economies. In today's highly technological and mobile, globally linked world, businesses can locate anywhere, and business owners will choose cities with clean air over cities with dirty air and high rates of asthma and lung cancer, where gas masks are recommended to keep children safe on red air days. Either we can be a leader in the global alternative energy industry, or we can watch our economy deteriorate along with the global economy. Either we can control our future with locally produced clean energy, can remain in thrall to the violent and highly erratic oil-producing countries of the Middle East. Our Mormon cultural heritage shows the way. For the highest good of our society and communities and way of life, we can choose the path of self-reliance, self-sufficiency, good stewardship, respect for the natural world, and conservation of natural resources. These were the core values that Brigham Young thundered for again and again from the pulpit. He understood the importance of seeing into the future, seeing the big picture, acting prudently in the short term for long-term social gain. Utah's net metering incentives program is better than some, but far behind those of Vermont, California, Germany, or Norway. Not only should there be no punitive fee for those taking capital risk to build out the solar economy, but we should strongly increase incentives for this all-important conversion that affects not just us, but the entire planet. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Questions for Mr. Wheeler? Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. You're excused. Amy O'Connor.
Give sworn testimony.
Thank you. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please be seated.
Thank you. Thanks for staying so late. Appreciate it. My comments are actually brief because I think everybody who has come before me has been eloquent and made most, if not all, the arguments that one could possibly make. And I oppose the rate increase. I live in Glendale. I am a Rocky Mountain Power client, customer, and I do have solar, so I'm part of the that program. So when I first came to Utah, my family came to Utah. And it turns out that a friend who lived in Utah, a friend of my dad, said, "Hey, Utah is family-friendly, Salt Lake is fantastic, come raise your family here." And I would say that if we are truly family-friendly, if we really care about kids, if we really care about future generations, then we must incentivize solar for all the reasons that Ray Wheeler pointed out, for all of the reasons that everybody else has pointed out, because they're the ones who are going to pay. And I don't even have children. I chose not to have kids. So I think we owe it to them, because I care deeply about future generations, it turns out. So I believe that we have a moral obligation to incentivize solar, not to punish people for investing in it. In fact, if we don't do what some countries in Europe, like Germany, are doing, I think we are, as we're going to be in trouble. And I would just ask you to go back to the saying, which I think may have started back in the 70s, maybe even on Earth Day, that we have to think globally and think of us as part of the global community. We're not just Salt Lake, and we're not just the Wasatch Front. We are connected, and we are responsible as global citizens. So I ask you to act locally. Please do the right thing for your children, future generations, for the globe, for biodiversity, which I happen to care about deeply as well. But let's do it for the future, and please don't start down this path of punishing folks, as in Utah we're only at 1% in terms of renewable energy. We need to go a long ways, and we need to do it very quickly. So I appreciate your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Questions? You're excused.
Thank you.
David Nimkin, followed by Eric Johnson, who I believe is our last witness. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please be seated.
My name is Dave Nimkin, N-I-M-K-I-N. I live in Salt Lake County, a customer of Rocky Mountain Power, and a net meter user as well. I will hopefully be mercifully short. I think Amy had said most everything had been indicated. I want to concur with a lot that had been said. There are actually some points that I'd like to make that are unique. So I appreciate everybody's attention and offer this. I very much want to encourage you all and the patience that you've endured tonight and the last couple of days on this to really do the right thing and reject this along with others. I believe in many ways that the proposal before you is intentionally incompatible, intentionally inconsistent, and intentionally irrational. Those are not good principles to be founded on, and I want to provide a few examples of why I think that's the case. 35 years ago, I was the executive director of an organization called Salt Lake Neighborhood Housing Services, now called NeighborWorks. We formed a partnership then with a group called Utah Power and Light. They were strong partners with us in promoting a solar neighborhood and investing in passive solar retrofits in that neighborhood based on the principle that they recognized that investing in new centralized power production and coal production was expensive, and they wanted to encourage and promote conservation. They recognized that an older neighborhood in East Liberty Park of Salt Lake City could benefit from applications of passive solar technology. They financed wraps of water heaters. They helped and provided caulking and weatherizing for over 1,200 homes in that neighborhood. So successful that two national magazines did stories of America's solar neighborhood. My question is, what's changed? What if we had done more of that over the last 35 years? And why is Rocky Mountain Power pursuing a strategy that is so profoundly contrary to that position? In my day job, I work with an organization called the National Parks Conservation Association. We protect America's national parks. I'm the regional director in the West. The national parks are in a large measure what defines this state. We've talked a lot about the impact along the Wasatch Front. I notice, for example, the posters of the national parks on the wall in the back out in the corridor. We take great pride in them. They are huge economic drivers for us. The wisdom of the U.S. Congress, at least at that time, in passing the Clean Air Act was to designate our national parks as Class 1 airsheds, and that a good deal of our work is involved in trying to restore and maintain Class 1 airsheds in America's national parks, and most specifically Utah's national parks. Pacific Corps is involved in some of that and considering fairly substantial capital investments to realize and fulfill the EPA guidelines for regional haze standards. I think it's very important that, and can't quite understand how the centralized power production that is inherent in the Utah Power or Rocky Mountain Power production is trumping the capability to increase renewable power. One other point, and I think this is an important part of this, is that one of the things that I have been involved in as well is co-founder and co-chair of an organization called Buy Local First. Some of you may have heard about that. There are over 4,000 businesses that are part of that. But the precept, the goal of that, is to promote public education and to help people recognize that individually they have the opportunity to make choices that protect their communities, protect the businesses in those communities. As a net meter customer and someone who is not a geek, as others have been, I don't measure what I do and how I do things. I have found that I am profoundly interested in the energy use that I have and the amount of energy that I contribute back into the grid, the amount that I save. And I believe that it's critically important, as others have indicated, the personal responsibility and accountability that we each have to be responsible. And in the same fashion as local first, I believe that the ability for Utah consumers to be able to become active and direct participants in managing and producing energy is critically important. So for the benefit of all of us and all the things that have been said, I really want you to really act responsibly, act in a way that will ultimately do the right thing for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nimkin. Questions for Mr. Nimkin? You're excused. Eric Johnson. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Please be seated.
So, what I'd like, I don't want you to do anything other than think about a few words.
Just before you address those words, would you state and spell your name for the record? Indicate for us if you're a Rocky Mountain Power customer or not.
Yes,
you're a
net, all of the above.
Net metering customer as well?
I am a net metering customer, current Rocky Mountain Power customer. They did not help put it on my roof. I did that with SolarTech's help. Spell my name as average can be, E-R-I-C-J-O-H-N-S-O-N. That's the only thing average in this whole room. I've heard average mentioned, I'm not going to stretch it, but a lot of times tonight, and that word's subjective, right? A lot, subjective, average, subjective. What is average about this? If this was average, you guys wouldn't be going home tonight because this room would still be full of people. This has somewhat to do about the squeaky wheel. Squeaky wheel gets the most oil because we want to quiet them down. Well, if this was average, we'd be wanting to quiet this down. But this affects, what, 1% of Utah customers. That is not average. That is far below average. So the word average, as it has been used in this room tonight, is highly subjective and should be dismissed. Because it's not average. You're not average. You're not average. You're not average. I'm not average. I'm not rich. I live in an old house, right? But do I have solar power? Yes. Why did I get it? It's slightly a different reason. I want my children to have a good life. And if I am removed from the earth for whatever reason, they inherit my home, their power bills are going to be almost gone. Yes, I do fall into the category where I produce more than what I consume. So at the end of the year, Rocky Mountain Power is going to get my bank. Okay, fine. But they're not giving me anything for that except, oh, you can use our grid when you need power. Well, if I'm consuming less than what I produce, maybe I don't need it. But the fact is as a whole, society needs a power grid. Give them a power grid is fair. What's not fair is to say, on average, we need to do this to people who have a net meter or who use minimal power or to do this. Because on average, break that down. You have some people who generate more and lose their bank. You have some people who break even. You have some people who generate less and consume. What part of that is average? Pick one. I guess. I don't know. But pick one. I know I'm not average. Nobody in this room is average. Okay? So I want to dismiss that term and go to the terms of what's fair. What is fair? Would any, just, you don't even have to give a show of hands, but I'm going to suggest there are people in this room that work off of salary. You signed up for the job because you get so much PTO and so much this and so much that. Oh, but now we have you hooked and you need this job You need this job, so now we're going to change your benefits. We're going to take away your medical benefits and go this route and say, oh, you have to do a high deductible plan. That's what Rocky Mountain Power is doing to us. We'll do this for you, but oh, wait, now that we have you hooked, we're going to change the rules without changing what we do for you. Where's the fairness in that? If we want to talk fair, where is the fairness in that? Let's change what we said we would do. All these additional fees, whatever they might be, there's like three of them, right? But we're going to now tax you for this because you made a conscious choice to get off the grid, whether it's for warm, fuzzy feelings or whether it's for money or whether it's for whatever. But where's the fairness? I don't see it. I really don't. So to me, if we want to continue upon what is fair, let's revamp the whole contract and say, okay, before we're going to charge these people with net meters, which is we're going to take from them, how can we give back? Rocky Mountain Power, I don't think you're going to find on the table for that. Why? Because it's going to take a little bit of the money out of their pockets. Fair. Rocky Mountain Power says fair. That's not fair. So maybe keep this on the docket for eternity until Rocky Mountain Power comes back and says, we're willing to change the contract. Not a one-way street, but a two-way street. Then you probably wouldn't have me here voicing my opinion. I would accept it. I'm here tonight not to save $5 a month. I'm here so my children can save $5 a month. If it were me, I'd just pay it. But I had to come here tonight. One, thank you for allowing me to have my voice, because that's the only thing we all have. Nobody can control that unless you decided to close the doors and said, Eric can't speak tonight, right? I have my voice, and thank you for that. But I came here for my children. I thought about the whole thing, and I was like, yeah, $5 a month, you know, okay, I won't go out to eat for one day a week or something, right? But can my children make that choice for themselves? No. Does everybody in here like the way we live today? You could probably find little pieces of stuff that you don't like. And odds are that's because your parents didn't come here, or my father or mother, didn't come to meetings like this to voice their opinion. So now you're and I am reaping their stuff. So if I want to help my child, I need to be here to say, hey, this doesn't sound right. Somebody might think it's fair. Somebody might not care. Somebody might think it's not fair. But where do we go? To me, where we go is you get Rocky Mountain Power to sit down with their customers and say, okay, look, one guy was in here, said he had a contract with them. Rocky Mountain Power helped put the stuff up on his house, but now they want to charge him more money for equipment they helped him put up there? That doesn't make sense. They want to charge me more money for overproducing? More money and take my overproduction, my bank? Let's say, here's an example. I know it is current, I lose my bank. But let's say this. Whoever's on PTO, you're now on a use it or lose it scenario. So if you don't use it, you lose it. That wouldn't be fair, would it? Because most PTO banks roll over so much per year. Maybe Rocky Mountain Power could do something like that and say, okay, because I personally think their cutoff of April or May, whatever, March or April, is a little weird, because now I have a bank and I'm coming into the months where I have to get hit the hardest. My bank goes down, but I lose all that. So I go into the hardest months of the year starting at zero, when I previously had a bank so that I could potentially get through those months easily. roll it over. Have them sit down and say, okay, look, we want to do this. We're willing to do this. Change with no change, I think, is bad. And that's what Rocky Mountain Power is offering. They're offering change with no change to their customers, other than more money in their pocket and more money out of ours. So averages, change without change, subjective. Am I rich? No. What I do want to say, though, is this. Public humiliation comes at a price. And if we all want to sit in this room and let Rocky Mountain Power humiliate us in public, that's our choice. I choose not to let that happen. I choose not to let them affect my children in a way that they believe is fair. They don't know that it's fair. There hasn't been enough research done. There hasn't been enough cutting the pie down and dissecting it and saying, okay, this is where our problems really are. This just says, we're going to attack this 1% because we think they're rich when they're really not. They won't say anything because it's just $5. I'm not rich. I work 40 plus hours, probably 50 to 60 hours a week. That's why I'm here speaking last, because I had to work. I came here and put my name on a piece of paper. That's why I'm here. Let's figure out something that's fair. The proposal that's on the table is unfair to the consumer or the customer. So I'm going to leave you with that, and you can go home and think about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions? Thank you. You're excused. And we're adjourned. Thank you very much for your participation this evening in our hearing.